Hi, this is Wayne Zell, and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, your video cast that's designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. And on our video cast, we always feature entrepreneurs and special guests to help you achieve that goal. And today, my special guest is Dr. Otis Fulton. Welcome, Otis.
Thank you, Wayne. Great to be here with you.
It's great to have you on the program. We interviewed your spouse last time, and we talked about turnkey systems, or turnkey for good, rather, and nonprofit fundraising. And we're going to get into that in a second, but let me give you a little bit of background on Otis's CV, resume. He's vice president for psychological strategy at Turnkey, which is a nonprofit consultancy. And as a social psychologist, he's a much sought-after copywriter for nonprofit fundraising messages. He's written campaigns for such organizations as UNICEF, St. Jude's Research Hospital, March of Dimes, Susan Komen, Autism Speaks, and dozens of other organizations. And his professional interests involve applying psychology to fundraising and donor behavior. So for those of you that are interested in fundraising and donor behavior, this is going to be a very cool session today. With his wife, Katrina Van Huss, he's the co-author of the books Dollar Dash, The Behavioral Economics of Peer-to-Peer Fundraising, which came out in 2017, and Social Fundraising, Mining the New Peer-to-Peer Landscape, which came out last year. He's a frequent speaker at national nonprofit conferences and writes a blog at Nonprofit Pro. Peeling the Onion is the name of the blog. He's got a PhD in social psychology from VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, and received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Virginia, where he played on UVA's first ACC champion basketball team, Wahoo Wah. So I'm very proud to have you on the show today. I was at that game, by the way, but I was not playing. So
very good. Very good. You remember we had short pants and long hair.
Oh, my God.
Back in the day. Yes.
Short pants. It was kind of revealing. Anyway, so we'll talk about the non-psychology of what you all are doing. But first, tell me a little bit about peer-to-peer fundraising. What does that mean? When I say I'm an expert in peer-to-peer fundraising, or Otis is an expert in it, what does that mean to the listeners?
What it means is you're pretty good at getting other people to ask their friends for money on behalf of an organization, to ask your peers to support something that you support. And the secret sauce is that you're not asking your friends to support the Richmond SPCA, for example, in my case. You're coming to them and then you're saying, hey, Richmond SPCA is important to me. Would you support me? Now, you know, it's easy for someone to say, hey, I'm a little tapped out, or the market's down, I'm not going to be able to make a contribution to the Richmond SPCA. But it's difficult for people to say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't support you today, Otis. That puts them in a very, very difficult position. So
you're asking them to do a favor for you, really.
It absolutely, peer-to-peer fundraising is a favor. And that's really the key to it. The top 30 programs, I think last year, raised about $3 billion in various peer-to-peer fundraising events. So, you know, this is a big money thing. It's an important thing to a lot of very important nonprofit missions.
So I'm not a psychologist. You are. You've got your PhD in psychology, and you've spent a lot of time really studying psychology. The first question I had on that was, why is peer-to-peer fundraising so effective when you're focused on the individual asking for the favor as opposed to helping the charity?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Wayne. You know, people want to say yes. You know, we grew up as social creatures, and, you know, our peer group is very, very important to us. And, you know, it gets back to evolutionary psychology. It's one chip that we're putting into our social group that we hope will be reciprocated in the future. And, you know, people think of, you know, what's the incentive behind, what's the survival incentive behind doing something like that? You can't think of it in terms of individuals, because back on the African savanna, where our brains evolved, we didn't survive as individuals, we survived as a group. So things that were good for the group were good for us as individuals. And by good, I just mean made it more likely that we had offspring that were going to survive. And so we grew up as people that were finely attuned to where we are in the social group and very, very finely attuned to helping our social group be successful.
That's a great answer. You know, I was watching a video of a seminar you gave in Russia, and in that video you gave an example of I guess it was a research project that was done at Stanford University, where the researcher, you know, came in and offered somebody a $10 bill and then asked for it back. Can you tell us that story? Because I think that's really helpful to understand the psychology of fundraising.
Yeah, you know, you're referring to something called the Ben Franklin effect, and I'll tell you why it's called that in a minute. But there's a researcher, John Jenks, out at Stanford University. He did a simple experiment where he asked people to come in, and he let them play a game, and everybody won. You know, the game was rigged, so you won about $10. And then at the end of this, one of three things happened to various subjects. One was... the researcher said, "Hey, you know what? I'm embarrassed, but I need that $10 for gas to get home. Could I have the $10 back?" And another, to some of the other participants, a third party came in at the end and said, "Hey, I'm sorry. I'm the psychology secretary. Dr. Jenks wasn't supposed to give that money away. I'm going to have that back. That's the department's money. It was a mistake." And then the third group of people, they just got to keep the $10.
Okay.
And then they just asked the simple question, who, you know, how much did you like the researcher, Dr. Jenks, in this case? And, you know, you would think that the people that got to keep the $10 were the ones that said that they liked him the most. But in fact, it was the people that had to give the money back to him, that had to do him a favor, that said that they liked him the most. And it kind of gets to a fundamental principle in psychology, you know, social psychology. People watch what they're doing, just like they watch other people's behavior. We watch what we're doing. And so, you know, what kind of a person do I do a favor for? Person I like. So if I did that person a favor, it makes sense to me that I'm going to like them. And so, you know, we always think that our attitudes drive our behavior, but many, many times our behaviors drive our attitudes. So, you know, the cart kind of goes before the horse.
Our behaviors drive our attitudes.
Sure, you probably heard the term cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I use it a lot.
Cognitive dissonance is a mismatch between our behaviors and our attitudes. That's one aspect of cognitive dissonance. And
okay. And
we hate for this dissonance to be there. So we try to resolve it. And so if we've already done something, we resolve it by changing our attitudes at the back end.
As a non-psychologist, again, I play one on TV, and sometimes in my estate planning practice when I'm dealing with individuals who have really messed up lives, but I am not a psychologist. What would somebody like me, who's not a psychologist, be most surprised to learn about how people think about wealth? What would we be surprised about?
Yeah, that's a real interesting question. And, you know, let me just say that in-depth study of social psychology, I can't think of any other field besides maybe physics that really transforms the way you view reality. And so just to answer your question, let me give you the study that was done about 10 years ago with airplanes. You know, a modern 757 is kind of a microcosm of the social environment. You're crammed together with a bunch of strangers in this social situation. You've got to behave in certain ways. And one of the things that it turns out is that a 757 with the first class section has the four times the rate of air rage as a plane without a first class section. And so
wow.
The reason for that is that people are constantly making these unconscious social comparisons, and the presence of a first-class section makes them aware of a social inequity that they find to be very, very stressful. And so, you know, just that's a long way of answering your question. But, you know, a person's wealth, the how wealthy they feel or how impoverished they feel is never an absolute thing. It's always in the result of a comparison that they're making with other people.
Okay.
With their peers.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not uncommon, and I'm sure you've seen this, to find people who are, you know, in an absolute sense, very, very wealthy, but they don't feel it. And why is it? Well, it's because they're comparing themselves to other wealthy people. So they feel very average. And, you know, that's one of the reasons it's very difficult to become satisfied by your wealth, because you're always looking where you are on the status ladder. And, you know, as you become more wealthy, your points of comparison change. Now you're not comparing yourself to everybody that works at the factory. Now you're comparing yourself to the people that you meet at your club. And right. So, you know, it's this constantly shifting point of reference that, you know, you're always chasing some other group to compare yourself with.
So the lesson, I guess, is, or the message, the thing that we're learning from this is wealth is relative. I had a question on that, by the way. On the airplane, on the 757, on the jet, were the people engaged in rage in the back of the plane, or were they in the first
class? These are the folks in coach, yes. Yes, the presence of a first-class section was the equivalent of a 9.5-hour air delay. If the plane boards from the front and you have to, I'm a 3-million-miler on Delta myself and spent plenty of time in the first class sections, you know, and up
when you need to
upgrades and so forth. And, you watch the people in coach having to walk by you with your cocktail and so forth and reading your book and so forth. Well,
yeah.
If they have to march through the first class section, that is the equivalent of a 6-hour delay. So yes, it's this sense of inequality. You know, because we're a cooperative species, we're acutely attuned to inequality in all kinds of aspects of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if people thought of wealth in more than just economic terms. That's why we call our show Blueprint for Wealth. And the wealth in the Blueprint for Wealth is not just your economic wealth, but it's your spiritual wealth. It's your psychological health, and that, you know, comprises your wealth, your health overall. And so, you know, if people were more, I think, attuned to the definition of wealth in the broader sense, that would be great. But when it comes to charitable giving, it really boils down to who's got the bucks and who should we turn to. I had a question about that. You know, I was on the board of Northern Virginia Family Service for several years, many years. And one of the debates that the board always got in was, who do we go to for our donations? Shouldn't we be going to higher net worth donors and asking them for big donations? And the answer always boiled back to, we maybe shouldn't be going to necessarily the highest net worth people. We should be going to the people that are part of our community, who participate in the community, who have empathy towards the things that we're supporting and trying to help, as opposed to just people with big pocketbooks. I mean, how do you respond to that as a peer-to-peer fundraising expert?
You know, I agree with you 100%. I can also say that most people who become high-dollar donors start as small dollar donors. You know, they get to know the organization. They like the way that you responded to them giving $100 or $200, say. They like some of the people that they met in the organization. And so, you know, we call peer-to-peer fundraising the front door of the organization for that reason. because, you know, it's the way that most high dollar donors are introduced. They don't start out giving a check for $10,000 or $100,000. They start out giving a couple hundred dollars and just see, you know, what happens from there. So you want to cast a big net.
So it's developing a relationship with these people, an ongoing relationship, peer-to-peer, right? I mean, that's essentially what you guys are teaching.
It's all about the relationship. It's all about the relationship with the donor. You know, people who have good relationships with the organizations that they support, they stick around. They have high lifetime value, as we say, because they find it very rewarding. And so those are the kind of experiences that you want to create for people. Yes.
Okay. You know, from a psychological perspective, from your expertise, what's the biggest problem in the United States regarding wealth today?
I believe that income inequality is a cancer on our society. And, you know, I see it in the nonprofit sector. You may have seen recently that the number of people giving donations is down quite a bit
in
the last 5 to 10 years. And, you know, I think it's this, that's one of the effects of income inequality. You know, when people feel like they are, let me put it this way. Again, it's not about the absolute dollars. When people compare themselves to others and they feel like they're lesser than in terms of wealth,
yeah,
they feel impoverished and they begin to act in an impoverished manner. You know, it's not just low-income countries that have high crime, low birth, you know, low life expectancies and so forth.
Right.
You can be in the United States or America or any other developed nation, and if you feel like you're impoverished compared to others in the society, you are going to live less long. You're going to higher rates of alcoholism. There's going to be more crime around you. There's going to be more suicide. You know, in the last 50 years, middle class earning has basically stayed stagnant. You know, if you adjust for inflation, the problem is that the high end has continued to accelerate away from them. So, you know, it's kind of like you're on a subway station and you're seeing the car leave, the gap's getting greater and greater. So mm-hmm. It makes you feel less and less than. And so, you know, it's the group that's really been just devastated is white males without a college degree. And, you know, we hear about it, but it's true. It's they have a declining life expectancy, a lot of self-inflicted kind of maladies, drug dependency. They make poor decisions. When people feel impoverished, they tend not to make good long-term decisions. They don't save money, for example. It's all kind of about living fast and dying, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, I think it's a huge problem for our society.
So that's impacting the number of donors that are able to give or willing to give to charity, and it's impacting the dollars directly as a result of that.
It absolutely is, and the sector is really struggling to deal with having fewer donors in the pool.
I've wrestled with this concept as well, you know, in advising clients on charitable giving and things like that. And these are some people that have much more than you and I and our friends would ever dream of having in terms of economic wealth. And the hardest part, I think, is convincing them that donating to charity, whatever charity they want to donate to or whatever they feel inclined to support, is worthy of their hard-earned money that they've, you know, used their blood, sweat, and tears to accumulate over their lifetime. They'd rather it go to their family if, you know, as the first choice. And the real question is, how much wealth do you need to live on for the rest of your life? And, you know, wouldn't it be better to share it? And wouldn't you feel better about sharing it based on the psychological examples that you've given us today? How do I convince people to give more to charity as one who believes that that's the right thing to do? It's a philosophical question.
It's a great question, and I think when I write copy for UNICEF, for example, I don't talk about the mission much. I talk about you. How is this going to make you feel? What kind of person are you? Are you the kind of person that, you set it up as an if-then? If you're the kind of person that believes social justice is something that that every American should care about, then support blah, 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 blah. That's what people like us do. And you really want to make it all about that individual. That the nonprofit is going to do good things with the money, that's kind of a given. Sure it is. I mean, they have to in order to be a good charity.
Right.
You don't want to focus on the mission so much. You want to focus on what that individual, what that person can make happen in the world, because that's what's really important. And, I have to say that charitable giving is one of the ways that people can have a tremendous impact on the world. And, you want to make them aware of that whenever you can.
One of the things I thought that my former nonprofit that I worked with, NVFS, did effectively was they said, well, what will a $500 donation? It'll feed X number of families. It'll clothe Y number of, single mothers. It'll provide education for them so that they can get out into the workforce and support themselves. I think quantifying it is probably a good way of convincing somebody to part with their hard-earned dollars to help a charity help others, but also getting them to feel good about helping others at the same time.
It's a great way to do it, and that's what I try to do all the time, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So the group that's been most impacted by this problem then is sort of the people who have been sort of thrusted into the impoverished zone simply because of the divergence in wealth in the United States, is what I'm hearing.
Yes. Yeah. It makes people feel very poor, even though they aren't. And again, it's all about social comparisons. People are experiencing shorter life expectancies, all these kinds of things, and it makes them focus on the here and now and less on other people.
So what are the long-term implications of this for charities, for our society?
Well, it's interesting. There was a study that was done a few years back. And by the way, if you're interested in wealth inequality, there's something you can Google. It's called the Gini, G-I-N-I, the Gini scale.
Okay.
It makes comparisons of the top 20% and the top and the lowest 20% of a group. And you'll find that America, United States, I believe Portugal has the highest, an average country like Sweden or Japan, where they have low income inequality, will be about 4. United okay. States is about 8 or 9. So we have very high inequality. Mm-hmm. But if you ask people, there was a study that was done a few years back, and they gave people two scenarios. One was in terms of wealth distribution. One was the United States, and one was Sweden, but they didn't call them United States and Sweden. They just gave them kind of the demographics. And then they asked them, well, what society would you rather live in, regardless of your sex, race, income, whatever? 92% said they'd rather live in Sweden. That sounded better to them. And again, it's because in an evolutionary perspective, we really don't like these situations of inequality. And I think that the American political system is kind of jerry-rigged our wealth distribution in ways that are really averse to what we think is fair. And I think that there are a lot of very bad political consequences that happened from this. So, I want people to be more aware of this, of what inequality does to us all. And I'd love to see it treated kind of like a public health problem, because I really think
it was interesting when you said 92% would rather live in Sweden.
Right.
I question that statistic because it depends on the demographics of the people that
It actually did not depend on the demographics.
No?
No. It was high-income people, low-income people, men, women. Didn't matter about race. It was very consistent across all demographics. And so...
When the Republicans, not to go political, are saying that we have to cut taxes and we have to stop spending on these frivolous programs, it's really focusing on only those that are donating to their campaigns.
Well, there's no doubt that the people that earn more tend to be more. The more you earn, the more you tend to be Republican. And there's no doubt about that.
So how do we change this so that everybody is going to be feeling better about our country, about themselves, and where do you see this going in the next election? I have no idea, but in the next 10 years, 20 years, if we're still alive.
I don't know, but I think that something has to give. And, I think we can do it very thoughtfully, or I think we can do it very not thoughtfully and go through a very, very difficult time. But again, I'm here to tell you, if you want to learn more about income inequality, there is a wonderful book that was written by he's a Tar Heel, Wayne, but,
I'll read it anyway.
Yeah, he's one of the good ones. his name is Keith Payne, and he wrote a book called The Broken Ladder. And this is kind of the seminal work. I think it's about 5 years old now, but Keith's work is just the seminal work. He's a social psychologist in this whole idea of inequality. And I can't recommend the book highly enough.
I'm writing it down right now. Keith Payne, The Broken Ladder, if you want to learn about income inequality. People talk about universal income, and they talk about, providing enough money to people so that they can live a normal life, with the ability to access healthcare, with the ability to go to school, attend schools that are of good quality. I mean, that is Sweden, isn't it? I mean, that's what we have learned in our travels. But yet people refer to that as a socialist society, when in fact it's just a very egalitarian society where equality is important. I mean, how would you react to my observation? Am I incorrect, or am I correct in saying, people look at that, some people look at that askance, but most people, 92%, would be okay in that type of environment. So what would we need to do to change the way we do things in this country to get more like Sweden so that people are happier and people are more willing to give to each other?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time some years ago in Japan, and you spend time in Japan and it feels like an alien society. They believe in things like 100% employment. These kinds of ideas. I think that the cult of the individual is so deeply ingrained in the American psyche that I think that it's just going to make things very difficult to dramatically change. We really tend to focus on the individual here, whereas in a place like Japan, they focus much more on the group. And so, you know, but and you see things in that society, like, you know, every morning I'd see young school kids in their school outfits on the trains. These are 7 or 8 year olds, and parents feel completely fine sending their little children on trains to schools. You know, here in the United States, you'd be out of your mind to suggest that. And yeah. Yet people assume that everyone in the community is going to look out for these children. And they do. And so I just think that our society has this sense of the individual that is going to make things very difficult for us to dramatically change.
You know, I went to the African American Museum here in D.C. This past weekend, and it was just mind-blowing, you know, to learn how the African societies were very much like the Japanese society in that they were very community and group oriented. And I think that's it's something that I guess it's something that we have to work on at the grassroots level and make it work community by community, group by group, charity by charity. I don't know how else to describe it. Making people more aware of the other people around us and not just focused on themselves to the detriment of others. So with that said, how do people find out more about Turnkey for Good, and where do they find you and Katrina so that they can tap into your expertise on peer-to-peer fundraising?
www.turnkeyforgood.com is our website. Please come visit us. We also have a podcast that we just started up last month. So you inspired us, Wayne, to start a podcast. So thank you for that. And I'm Otis at turnkeyforgood.com. Katrina at turnkeyforgood.com. So we're pretty easy to find. If you go to the website, you'll find our contact information as well.
I think what you do is very important for our society, and I thank you for that. I thank you and Katrina both for that, because you're doing something good for everyone, and not just helping charities raise money. It's helping charities fulfill their purposes and their missions to help communities and help people who have less than the rest of us. So I think I laud you for that, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much. Let me just end by saying, you know, people that get involved with charities in a meaningful way, it's often the most satisfying relationship of their lives. And, you know, there's research that says that people who are involved in two or more nonprofits, they actually have a longer life expectancy. So, you know, this is just something that's very rewarding for people. And so I urge everyone, you know, for themselves to, you know, find something that is gratifying for them, is satisfying for them, because it can become one of the most important things in your lives.
I think you're right. I think it makes you feel good, and it makes you live longer, and it gives you good emotions and good feelings. So with that, we'll say thank you to Otis Fulton for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth. And join us next time on Blueprint for Wealth for another special guest and an educational moment focusing on a special topic of interest to you, our special listeners. Have a great week. Hi, this is Wayne Zell, and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth's educational moment. Today, we're going to talk about when should you sell a piece of your company to a non-grantor trust. What's an installment sale of a company? How does it work? Well, in an installment sale, you could sell part or all of your business to a trust for the benefit of your spouse and family for a promissory note that bears interest only, with the principal amount becoming due at a specified maturity date in the future. Depending on the duration of the note, the IRS's applicable federal rate would determine the interest rate. And while the note may or may not be secured, it has to be enforceable under local law. What's an example of an installment sale involving a business? Well, one example may be where you're selling an appreciated business interest either to your kids or your heirs directly, or
to a non-grantor trust established for the benefit of your children or heirs in a taxable installment sale. What's the advantage of selling to a non-grantor trust? Well, at least one advantage of selling to a non-grantor trust is that it allows you to lock in the capital gains at a fixed value while deferring the recognition of gain until payments are made under the promissory note. The strategy effectively transfers the appreciation in value to the trust beneficiaries. How is the tax handled for interest and principal payments that are received from the buyer? Well, interest that's received from the buyer is taxable at ordinary income rates, which can be as high as 37% federal. On the other hand, principal payments are subject to tax as long-term capital gains, which might include a return of capital, but only when the principal payments are actually received. What's the difference between using a grantor trust versus a non-grantor trust? If you sell the business interest to a grantor trust, which means that the income of the trust is taxable to you as the grantor, the sale is ignored for income tax purposes. In other words, the trust doesn't pay income tax, you do. So you're treated as if you're selling the interest to yourself. But in a non-grantor trust, which is treated as a separate taxpayer, the note will allow you to defer income tax until the installment of interest and principal payments are received. One main exception to this rule is when the buyer is related to the seller and sells the assets within 2 years of the original purchase. In that case, the gain will be accelerated. If you want to know more about sales to non-grantor trusts, grantor trusts, or trusts in general, contact us at zelllaw.com. And if you want to read more about some of these techniques, you should check out my book, Your Multi-Million Dollar Exit, which is available on Amazon as well as at waynezell.com.